You're with Capital Radio 101.7 FM and Capital Digital, broadcasting to you from Wireless Hill in Ardross, which is in Perth, Western Australia. Our panel, if you like, is back tonight to continue our discussion. There's our resident military historian, Nigel Rogers. There is our newly groomed commentator for the program, John Goodlad, and here's me with very little to offer. But anyway, we'll start. We have had a number of phone calls regarding last week's broadcast, gentlemen, and one of the things there was that would like a little more about Ukraine then and now. So we'll go to the then. With you, Nigel, do you remember about 3 years ago, of course, on the eve of the war beginning, we had a program. Can you cast your mind back to what was said then?
I remember it very well, Tony. It was actually, as I remember, I think the evening before Ukraine was invaded.
It was, yes.
And we had an interesting discussion with another gentleman who also very knowledgeable on the field. And he, as I remember, suggested he didn't think Russia would invade. I was contra view, very strongly of the view that the Russians would invade for all sorts of reasons.
Do you remember why he was more positive about things at the time?
I think he really believed that, you know, the Russians really didn't want to do this, and that Ukraine was well prepared, and that this was an unnecessary move by President Putin at the time. And he just had many views that suggested this was definitely not going to happen, despite the fact that clearly forces were massing on the Ukrainian
border. So why did you have a different viewpoint?
Because I felt that it seemed clear to me that they wanted to invade, to bring down the government in Kyiv, President Zelensky, to retake the country. All the intel said that there were masses of troops and tanks assembling on the border. That was all available in the public domain. And the other key thing, the weather was changing. Coming out of the Ukrainian winter.
I remember now.
And, you don't want to be dealing with all this in the winter. The ground is important for tanks, mobility and so on. So the weather conditions were in favouring. That takes you into the spring, which makes it easier to operate militarily. So timing is important, as it is in every military campaign.
I'm being fatuous, but yes, you were right.
Yeah, sadly, I was right, and we all woke up the next morning and heard that Ukraine was being invaded. So yeah. It was not something I was very happy to predict correctly, but that's what happened.
Yeah. Right, John, can you cast your mind back to even perhaps a bit before the actual declaration of war? Where was your thinking then? Why was it? Did you think in a particular way? And how is it different now?
Well, I think some very good points were just made, including the weather, particularly in that part of the world. But it was clear that the troops were massing, the tanks were massing, the Russians were trying to pass that off as manoeuvres and practice games, etc., etc. I think the key issue was, when asked about it, President Biden said, what would the US response be? He basically said, well, sort of depends.
Yes.
I don't know if you recall that, but it was, you know, if it's a low level sort of incursion, you know, almost gave it the heads up. We're not going to get too worried about that.
Yes.
And then it was a full scale invasion. I mean, I think
the surprise was evident, wasn't it? Was in everybody's mind.
Well, I think there's always been three scenarios, and one was partition, the other was full invasion of Ukraine, and I have no doubt. I'm not sure whether you agree, Nigel. Mm. The plan was to take over Ukraine. I mean, there were people who'd been paid off. There was an alternative government there. I think they thought it would be accepted that line of tanks that would go in would crush all in front of it, the parachuters that landed, etc. Well, the opposite. I mean, the first 2 years of the war was extraordinary fight back by Yes. Ukrainians. Now, you extraordinary.
You were in Europe before this, though.
Well, that's right. The invasion, the first leg of the invasion, of course, happened before 2014. Mm. And I was lucky enough to represent the Institute and visit NATO headquarters, and they were all in shock. They were genuinely hurt on a personal level yeah. by the fact that the Russians had done what they did. So, you know, I had General so-and-so in here, and he said the following, and, you know, it had been a time of, well, I suppose, reassuring Russia, cozying up to Russia, you know, we're taking these new allies and partners on, etc., but, you know, let's continue to work together for the good of Europe and the good of mankind. And that was the narrative. After two or three days of this, there were the group that I was with, we had people from Japan, New Zealand, Australia, Korea, Pakistan, etc., partners, NATO partners. And after two or three days of this, we said, well, what did you expect? The Russians were going to give up the Crimea. The Russians were going to let you have the base where the fleet, you know, the proper port for the fleet, etc. Surely it wasn't that unexpected, but if it was, you know, get real. And so that was 2014. The other thing I think people forget, and I think you reminded people last week, that Ukraine used to be a nuclear power. Mm. After the demise of the Soviet Union, there was an agreement where Ukraine would disarm and both sides would support their independence and their territorial sovereignty. Obviously, that didn't happen. So I think what happened in 2-3 years ago was plain and obvious. I think the scale of it, to my mind, was not so obvious.
Right. So that's the then. What about the now? How different? We'll go to Nigel first. How different from that when we did that broadcast, for example? Mm. How different is the world as you see it in light of Ukraine now?
Well, you know, there are so many geopolitical major events going on around the planet. You know, you since the invasion of Ukraine, obviously Ukraine, initially Crimea. I mean, don't forget, there's been a proxy war going on in Ukraine for a very long time before it was even invaded in, you know, 3 years ago in that famous February invasion. So this proxy war in the eastern part. But, you know, what else has blown up? We now have, you know, this terrible conflict in the Middle East of Palestine and Gaza, Israel, you know, and all the ghastly things that have gone on there. We also have the very worrying prospect of, you know, Taiwan. What ultimate is China's intentions on Taiwan? I think it's clear that as far as China is concerned, they see that as part of Greater China, and they wish that to be brought back into the fold, as it were. And it seems clear to me that is the ultimate aim. It's only a question of when and how that might play out in terms of what will happen there. And, you know, there are other conflicts going on all around the world, particularly in Africa. A lot of them are terribly tragic, and thousands of people are dying in these civil unrest across Africa, apart from the Middle East. You have some trouble in South America, but it's quite limited to Colombia, Mexico, tends to be drugs cartel wars. So, you know, there's an awful lot going on. And the other thing that's happening is people, you know, there is still a food shortage. People are still dying, yet, you know, we are so prosperous economically. There are people still dying of food shortages due to, you know, all sorts of reasons, famine, but civil war, violence plays a large part in it, but also global warming, weather pattern changes and other things that are going on. It's a complex scenario.
Before I ask John for his comments there, can I just tell you that I am now thoroughly depressed? you know, and one silly question came into my mind, and I'll throw it first to you, John, is that can any nation anywhere afford a war?
Nigel and I were lucky enough yesterday to be at a presentation by Professor Geoffrey Blaney, who's almost prophet-like.
Yes, in his, the grand man.
The grand man. I mean, a great, arguably Australia's greatest historian, but also prepared to comment as well. I think, can a country like Australia afford to go to war? He talked about what happened to Australia and how quickly this extraordinary Japanese advance occurred, Singapore bombing Darwin within a few weeks, etc. Yep. How quickly that
Second
can happen.
World War, there we go.
How quickly that can happen, and it can happen again. He stressed the importance of countries like Australia having allies. Our allies, the United States of America, and he's really strongly of the view that notwithstanding the current president's nature, which has been tested before over his last presidency, that, frankly, the subtext was we should do everything in our power to be almost all the way with LBJ, that sort of thing, because we get we get so much from that. Now, Nigel's point about Taiwan, clearly the massive build-up of the Chinese naval fleet and their ability to fly over, jam the communications, do everything, gives China a lot of options in terms of what it does with Taiwan. How does it incorporate Taiwan? If they go the full Monty, as it were, and invade, it's a seaborne invasion. And I think Geoffrey Blaney made the point, I'm sure, from a military perspective, when in my former days in foreign affairs, the Chinese couldn't mount a seaborne invasion of Taiwan. It was decades away, and we knew that. They could do lots of other things, but they couldn't do that. The issue is whether by 2027, which is, I think, the day of liberty, if you like, to use the, the local a current expression, whether they'll be ready to do that, whether they can do that, or whether it be, as tends to be in history, it'll be a massive failure. But I think I'd be really interested in the scenarios that surround Taiwan and reincorporation, taking into account the fact that we are allies, but there's a question mark as to US. It all depends, so much depends on the US. Ukraine depends on the US.
John, we'll pick up from where you left off, I think, and, well, both of you were talking about Professor Blaney's insights. Where should we go on from what you've been saying there? What's the next line of topic that you think is important?
Well, I think I would come back to Taiwan. In fact, Professor Blaney feels that Taiwan is actually the most dangerous situation, particularly in our region, in our region, that we potentially face. And there is no doubt. I mean, the current regime in China have long held the view that Taiwan needs to be incorporated back into China. So it's not a question of when, but, you know, not or how, but, you know, it seems that it's going to happen.
Can I bust in there, though, Nigel? Because of this has always fascinated me. We had a similar, well, non-violent situation in one sense with Hong Kong, didn't we? And that was an entirely different scenario.
Well, different scenario completely, because
Everything happened with trumpets and flags going up and down.
Yeah,
and people
I mean,
cheering.
Hong Kong's completely separate scenario, I would suggest. You know, it was.
We can't Ireland learn from that, is really what I'm asking.
What can you learn? That, you know, ultimately, you know, it's Hong Kong has changed out of all recognition. I mean, perhaps we don't want to go into a lot of micro detail there, but. You know, what was supposed to be a 50-year transition period, was it 50, I think, was agreed by Margaret Thatcher. Obviously, that has kind of, you know, disappeared and changed. And so things have changed. So agreements are put in place, a bit like the Ukraine agreement originally, when they took away their nuclear weapons, decided to, you know, get rid of them. But so agreements can be broken. I think that's a key lesson out of all of this. People break agreements. But, you know, if we come back to Taiwan, There is a person, the Admiral Philip Davidson. He's the former commander of the U.S. Pacific Indo Command here, and he took. There's something called the concept of the Davidson window, and it's become a sort of key point of discussion around what China might do about Taiwan. And John has sort of alluded to this, and you know, the kind of timing seems to be anywhere from last year through to 2028, with 2027 being the sort of favourite year for this to happen. And
what was it? What that you used a term, Davidson?
He was a naval U.S. naval commander, so he predicted that this was
his prediction.
His prediction is known as the Davidson window. Yeah, and so yeah. And there are sort of various other reasons why this may happen, apart from the fact, obviously, it's a key objective of the Chinese government. There is things like the centennial of the People's Liberation Army in 2027, another event that can kind of make the whole thing perhaps possibly more likely is when the U.S. near semiconductor sovereignty, because don't forget, Taiwan, a lot of it is about semiconductors. They make all these conductors that are used in everything you can think of from A to Z. And it's a very, very efficient, high-quality product produced by Taiwan. Now, if the United States is able to move into a situation where they don't have to rely on Taiwan, that could kind of change the dynamics. And, what are some of the factors that might contribute to sort of triggering the event? It could be a kind of a distraction by the United States. You know, if something happens on the Korean Peninsula and, you know, China thinks, well, they're involved in that, so maybe now's the time to move. The health of the Chinese president, if he became ill, I think he's looking for his legacy to be that he reunited China with Taiwan. Bit like, I would suggest, President Trump, his legacy, he wants to probably win the Nobel Peace Prize. That's what he probably would like to see on his tombstone. If there's some kind of provocative act, say politicians visiting Taiwan, you remember when Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, China really got very, very upset, and there were all sorts of military maneuvers took place. There was a huge one in 2024, when they effectively were practicing encircling and, embargoing the island of Taiwan.
So, with all of these things, and John, your experience obviously is important here. We get these things, events coming up. How important are they in the minds of presidents and generals or whatever in bringing a conflict as part of that event? Does it mean you win more wars when you're waving a flag and sending bunting around the shops? I'm being silly in my explanation, but it does worry me that these things are all pegged on extracurricular activities.
Well, absolutely, indeed they are. They're often the personality of the leader and the autocracy that is behind the leader. I think the important thing from an Australian perspective and from an international relations perspective is that we should not be reacting to strange events that happen in the future, that we're resilient and strong and we're strongly allied and our values are in line. One word, I think there are two aspects of the Taiwan-China issue, and there are two Ds, democracies, that is a democratic country, they both say they're part of China, etc., a democratic entity, if you like. But the other word, the other D word is deterrence. We had a visit from a Japanese admiral a few years ago. And Japanese are very much into deterring aggression by the People's Republic against themselves and against Taiwan. A lot of people forget Japan used to run Taiwan. It was a part of the Japanese Empire at one stage. But deterrence means that we need to be ready and not responding to the quirks of leaders that we have sufficient ballast, if you like to.
Okay, can I take that a little further? Therefore, in our education systems, both from schools to universities to community organisations, are we strong enough in our convictions of our own democracy and all those sorts of things, or is that somewhere where we need to be having a good look?
Well,
there's a
third D, if you like, despair.
Yes.
Now, I saw this the other day, I've got to say, Nigel, with my daughter. We were watching a show about Australian fashion, and we're talking about the 1970s, the fabulous moustaches on the guys, and fabulous fashion, Jenny Key doing her thing, Trent Nathan, but this whole Whitlam-esque patriotic world of Australia. And my daughter said, was it really like that then?
Yeah.
You know, it was a fun time. It was a great time to be alive, a great time to be an Australian.
Yes.
She now says it's very despairing and gloomy, even though we're better off, etc. Now, the question is, and I was chatting to a former colleague in Canberra, very senior Mandarin in Canberra, the other day, and he made the point, would the younger generation, would our sons and daughters sign up to fight for our country and our values, particularly in a place if it involved Taiwan?
Yes.
Our interests in that freedom of navigation and all the exports that go through the various choke points here, which would be closed, and you know, the ability to close us down very quickly, would they fight?
Yeah. Well, interestingly too, in a corollary to that, is a few weeks ago we had a young man broadcasting for us about his work in lifting the consciousness of the 44th Battalion from the First World War as one of a big West Australian contingent that we should be proud about. And he's very keen at 19 to make that story vibrant to his age group and us all. But perhaps that's unusual.
Yeah.
And perhaps it shouldn't be unusual. I'm getting a bit sort of grumpy old man now, I suppose, but it worries me that I was so proud of what he was carrying on about.
Yeah.
We need more of it.
It's interesting you say that, Tony. You know, I was reading some research and articles recently, actually read the UK, and they are having, you know, like everywhere, want to recruit more people into the military. And they've done research that says a very high proportion of young people would not be interested in defending their country and fighting for their country.
Mm.
And, you know, saying I don't really feel that British, and, you know, I don't think I'd want to get involved in anything where, even if it meant I've got to defend my country. So that, you know, it's a point of view that, you know, is there, and it is what it is. But it's interesting how the kind of psychology and thinking of people has changed.
I think too that we've taken a tangent to what we've been here to talk about, but an important tangent, and I think it bears a great deal of thinking about. Up to date Ukraine thoughts, please.
Right. Well, The negotiations continue. A lot of them are being held in the Middle East, in Riyadh and Jeddah, between the Americans and the Russians. You know, the Ukrainians are sort of sitting on the sidelines, although they keep Zelensky informed, President Zelensky. I think where we are now, apparently, allegedly, there is an agreement between that the Russians and the Ukrainians that the Black Sea will be opened up for trade to continue. Grain exports out of Ukraine are very vital to the economy of Ukraine. So freedom of navigation, no attacking of ships. I think, as I understand it, the Russians have countered by saying, well, yes, but we want certain conditions. And a key one for Russia, of course, is for their banking system to be freed up so that they can move money around the planet in the financial plumbing system of the world. So they want those sanctions lifted that allow them to effectively move funds around the world.
So essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong, essentially you're seeing it now as we are talking more about commerce, we're talking more about scientific discovery in the metals and all that sort of area, and then the ships getting around. Rather than, as we have been in the past couple of years, about guns and planes. And
well, yes. No, you're right. I mean, there is talk, for example, that the Americans would take over the power plants in nuclear power plants. And don't forget, Ukraine has, I think, the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe, that they would run those. And also rare earth minerals that, you know, American mining companies would be allowed to get involved in that. So it's turning, you know, that is, they are being used, I suppose, in a way as bargaining chips to try and come to some agreement between Russia and Ukraine in terms of, you know, allowing the door to open to a more peaceful environment so that these things, these deals can be done. Because obviously everybody's fighting each other. It's very difficult to carry out some of these ideas.
John, then how do we equate all that with the understanding that one nation sent troops in to take over another nation? It seems to me there's a huge fence to climb between those practicalities and those things of people's existence at a level that we call democracy as opposed to authoritarianism and so on. I know I'm being very sort of, but it is a concern.
It is a concern. And look, in international relations terms, unfortunately, it's a lesson in realism. The country was invaded. The outcome, and we talked about this last week, the outcome is increasingly likely to be a ceasefire, an armistice, if you like, with occupied territories on one side and a remnant Ukraine, 80% of its territory on the other. The important thing is some form of security guarantees, and the Russians are doing everything they possibly can to make sure that that's not the case. I agree with one thing we learnt, and we talked about it here, in many ways you had a bit of a scoop here last week, because it was the idea for the United States to have control of critical minerals, etc., and power stations in Ukraine was a Ukrainian suggestion, and the Americans liked it. Yes. So it had been presented very much as something that, you know, a thought bubble from from Trump, quid pro quo. But I think the key thing we need to look at is the security guarantees that keep the rest of Ukraine free.
Yes.
And the ability, therefore, to invest in Ukraine, if people don't invest in Ukraine, the country gradually
is gone.
Yeah. So, it all depends on the Europeans. The good thing, and we talked about it last week, was the Europeans. Now, the European economies together are larger than the economy of the United States. Yet they spend so little on defence, and we heard the Vice President say in the last couple of days when it was, it's not Twittergate, it's Signalgate or whatever.
Signalgate.
Saying that, yes, you know, those bloody Europeans freelading on us again. Hey, the view from the United States is this is very much a European issue. It's their front yard. They should be fixing it. So there are all sorts of suggestions for boots on the ground to provide those security guarantees. It's an absolutely fascinating space to watch over the next few weeks, but I would say it is over the next few weeks, because I agree entirely with Nigel that President Trump wants to plant the flag in the ground and is looking very much at being recognised for being able to halt the gunfire.
Do you think with his position, I'm never quite sure what his position is on certain things, but the expressed distaste for NATO, Does that mean that there's the possibility that that will give NATO away?
I think therein lies the problem. The Russians have made it quite clear they do not want NATO troops on the ground to ensure a security agreement, a coverage for Ukraine. Therein lies the problem, because the coalition of the willing, which is trying to be put together by President Macron and Prime Minister Starmer of the UK, they de facto, they're all NATO countries. So the idea of security guarantee by having troops on the ground isn't going to fly. What ironically, if you stand back and think about it, if you have a lot of, to put it bluntly, American companies digging up half of Ukraine and running power stations, you've suddenly got all these thousands of Americans on the ground. Now, ironically, in a way, obviously not the same as having NATO troops, but, would the Russians dare attack and start trying to blow up Americans who are digging up, Ukraine? Mm. I mean, I'm being a bit flippant here, but, they're kind of in a weird way.
Well,
there's so much, there'd be so much investment going on from the United States.
There's almost a corollary between Pearl Harbor and what you're saying then in that case.
Well, not.
Because, it was only really when there was that major confrontation with Japan in the Second World War that the Americans took the thing
Pearl Harbor,
seriously.
The reasons for that are, quite different. I mean, Japan.
Yeah, I know, but no, I just mean the thing, the actual happening.
Yeah, no,
happening.
I understand the happening, but all I'm saying is think of the risk associated with Russians killing Americans, engineers and miners working in Ukraine.
Mm.
How would that go down with President Trump and the administration there?
Well, we saw another example in my mind, of course, was the Twin Towers. That was, everybody was saying there is going to be a world war. Mm. There wasn't, thank goodness.
Mm.
But it was a great tragedy in itself that coloured the way people thought.
Yeah. But I think back to John's point, it's very interesting that, as John said, it was really President Zelensky's a Ukrainian idea about the minerals deal. And people forget that sometimes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm conscious of time.
Mm.
But there are certain things we haven't talked about. John, what are a couple of those?
Well, look, walking out of the office today with Bloomberg on the screen and all that sort of thing. So the world comes to a stockbroking firm. It's all there. It's all there in the markets. But there was the Vance visit to Greenland and President Trump being asked directly, surely you're not serious. He said, we want Greenland.
Mm.
So this is, we talked about this last week, Nigel, that this is less of a, this is almost a 19th century paradigm that pre-World War I, that nation states come along. This is the age of empires that we're looking at.
Mm. You stole Alsace-Lorraine, all from First World War.
Exactement. That's the way. But so the fact that we're even having this discussion, the fact that Vance and his delightful wife, the vice president's going to Greenland, and that the president is saying, because we want to take you over, is quite extraordinary.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Panama and Canada, what do the Canadians have to do to deserve
Panama?
Now, listen, you two. I was starting to get quite
I'm going to make you a bit more pessimistic. John's absolutely right. what else is going on? Canada, can you imagine? Who would ever have thought that, Canada, is sort of in this huge tension and economic war with the United States now? Effectively, what's going on? Is America trying to economically destroy Canada that would then force it into a union with the United States? This is, when you think about it, it's unbelievable.
Well, I would tend to believe it in the sense that I've been prepared for it. There's a wonderful television series called Murdoch Mysteries, and it's a Canadian production. And they often have a storyline where, if I would summarize it, that their attitude towards their American cousins is, and consequently, I'm prepared for it.
Yeah, no, Mark Carney, of course, has spoken very boldly. He's just called an election. He's a former the governor of the Bank of England, the Bank of Canada, and he said there is never, ever, ever going to be any chance of, you know, the United States taking over Canada.
No.
So, but I just mentioned a couple of other things very quickly. John touched on it. Panama Canal. America, you know, President Trump seems very keen to take that back. It used to be under U.S. control.
Yes, it did.
In fact, I think the Chinese actually have just recently sold all their. They own a lot of the ports at either end of the canal. They've just sold those, and that I think must be part of the American pressure. The other thing that I would
is
mention,
Darwin up for sale?
Oh no, they bought it already.
The other thing I would mention quickly is Turkey.
Yes.
What's going on in Turkey? Turkey has the largest standing army in Europe. It's a member of NATO. It's a very key partner. The Americans have an air force base in Turkey, and you know, it is a very strong military state. But you know, there is a lot of unrest now in Turkey. It's a very important country in that region. And, you know, the mayor of Istanbul, who was the key opponent of President Erdogan, has just been locked up by President Erdogan. And there are riots going on. People are not happy in Turkey. That is, you know, a bit of a powder keg that is beginning to boil up there. It's not good.
John, I just ask you for your final comments because, no, before I do that, I'm going to say to you two and put you on the spot with the microphones wide open and witnesses at home to hear. I think it would be important if in a few weeks' time we reassemble to again say, okay, what's happening now on these and other allied topics, because I would suggest, John, and correct me if I'm wrong, but all of these things have a ramification in each other, be it from China to Muck
Venezuela.
And Boom.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So can I ask, Nigel, are you happy to come back
indeed.
With some more to talk about? John?
It's a fast-moving situation.
It is. Yes.
I mean, I've said this to people about the US election, you know, that people get very upset about President Trump and what have you. So there's nothing you can do about it from here. So enjoy the theatre.
Yes.
And look, I would dearly love to talk about, contrary to popular belief, the world is not falling apart. There's never been a better time to be alive or sick, for that matter. And prosperity is there, and peace breaks out in great swathes of the world.
Yes.
So even looking at President Trump's impact on, you know, an errant country like Venezuela, which are towing the line, they realise that if it is a new age of empires, that's a sphere of influence. They have to be very careful. Just like Colombia was when it quickly changed tack when they had to receive some of their uninvited guests in the United States back.
Right.
So perhaps, Tony, you're talking about trying to have a more positive discussion.
Yes. come to
reasons
forget,
to be cheerful.
Yeah, forget Dr. Google and just listen to the listening post on Capital Radio. And you'll all jokes aside, I think there is so much happening and happening so rapidly
that
we can't just close a discussion. We've got to keep it open. So if you two gentlemen will come back to the studios to have a discussion in a couple of weeks' time, we'll see how we go and see what's happened in the world. But tonight, thank you, John. Thank you, Nigel, for being with us again.